Hej och välkomna till avsnitt 1232 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser. Sveriges enda konservativa USA-podd med mig, Ronny Berggren, som kan stödjas med en gåva på swishnummer 070-3028-950. I detta avsnitt följer ett samtal med den republikanske strategen Justin White, som arbetat för en rad högt uppsatta republikaner, från George W. Bush till Mike Huckabee och Donald Trump, om Trump-teamets anklagelser om valfusk. Varmt välkomna. Justin White, welcome.
Good to be with you, Ronnie.
We're going to talk about the election in the United States on November 3rd. And, you know, to start, when was it obvious to you which candidate had won?
Well, I would say that it was a pretty strong indication that Donald Trump was not headed for a easy victory when the states of Georgia and North Carolina were not just quick and easy victories. That was the first indication that there was trouble in Denmark, so to speak. And so that combined with the U.S. Senate race just falling to pieces in Arizona for the Republicans as well. The truth is the loss of Arizona makes the pathway to the presidency very, very difficult for Republicans.
Yeah, you know, I got my hopes up when Florida reported so early that Donald Trump had won, but it didn't seem to help.
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. And likewise, when Florida reported so early, it did give a strong indication of a decent campaign. But the truth is that I do believe, yeah, in the way that Georgia and Texas are becoming slightly more Democratic, Florida is seeming to become more and more Republican due to a wealthier New York and New Jersey folks moving there, and perhaps a bit of Californians as well who want to maintain the climate but don't mind moving across the country.
Yeah. Okay. We really haven't. It took a couple of days before the media said that Biden had won. So maybe it was 3 days or something. But and I don't really remember the Electoral College when they said that he had won.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously they're still doing a bit of final counting in a couple of states, Georgia, North Carolina, being chief among them. But it does appear that Joe Biden has won almost exactly the same number of Electoral College votes as Trump won in 2016 at 306.
Yeah. You know, before we go into the details here, during this year, Donald Trump has complained a lot about mail-in ballots. And, you know, has that criticism been, you know, justified? And can you explain what mail-in ballots is and why Trump complained about it?
Yeah, so typically in the United States, in all but a handful of states, most voting is done either in person on election day or in person but early at early voting sites. Now, mail-in balloting is technically legal for absentee. Mostly it's utilized by folks in, you know, older care facilities and people in hospital. It's not something that's widely utilized in America in most states. Now, there is a glaring exception in Washington State, California, and Colorado, which have gone to an all-mail balloting system over the last 5 or 6 years. So those states are uniquely different from the rest of the U.S. in that regard. But of course, when you don't physically see the person, and they don't have to physically confirm their identity in any way, shape, or form, it does allow at least the possibility for there to be a bit of gamesmanship, shall we say. And while I do think that there are not only some validity to the concerns around that, and I will go one step further and to say that we know pretty much every single election for the last many years, there is always at least a handful of occasions where someone takes advantage of that, either voting their, you know, infirm mom or dad's vote, or perhaps if they're a caretaker doing the same. But numerically and statistically speaking, it's not very significant.
Mm. But, you know, Donald Trump said that this is something new, that when we have, you know, mail-in ballots in all of the nation, and this is a new situation, and it is much more dangerous now. Was it no truth to that?
And so there's the real concern, right? I do think that it is good to be vigilant for things like this, but in as much as it's not enough to be afraid of what can happen, you have to have evidence of what did happen. And there is no significant evidence that there were, more than perhaps a few hundred instances nationwide, which is certainly not enough to call into question any outcome, even in a single state, let alone nationwide.
Yeah. You know, after November 3rd, Donald Trump and his team, Rudy Giuliani and a lot of others, have put in lawsuits in, I think it's in six different states, and they are talking about mail-in ballots problem, they're talking about cheating, they're talking about problems with the electoral machines and with the software, Dominion, and things like that. Can you talk a little bit about, broadly, about Donald Trump's, what he accuses, about the problems he accuses the system of, and then your thoughts about his about that.
Sure. So obviously different states have different small rules. Some states allow votes to be turned in for several days after the actual election date, usually based around the concept of the postmarking of when that ballot was mailed, so that the voter had an intent to get it there, but obviously due to postal issues, it may take 3, 4, 5, 6 days to get there. Also, because the United States has a considerable number of military personnel stationed around the world, it can take quite a long while. Sometimes, even if you mail your ballot a week before Election Day, if, for instance, you're sending it from Germany, where we have many thousands of Americans, or even Iraq and Afghanistan, where we still have many thousands of Americans, or South Korea, it's possible for, you know, if they're voting in the state of, you know, Georgia, for instance, it may take as many as, you know, 10 to 15 days to get there from those military bases. And so we want to make sure, especially those serving our country, have their ballots counted, likewise at U.S. embassies around the world, et cetera. So there are, you know, many, many tens of thousands of ballots that come in from around the world to the U.S. in this regard. Also, it's, you know, as evidenced, due to coronavirus, certainly the number and size and scale of the mail-in balloting is unprecedented. And that always leaves a little bit of concern when a system is going to be stressed beyond its normal boundaries. That's one of the reasons why the balloting count took so many days instead of the night of or the morning after, as has been typical in elections past, especially for those of you and your listeners who are well familiar with past elections in the U.S. That being said, there is room for challenges, both around individual precincts or individual procedures that were followed at the state or local level. And I do think that's what is the basis of most of litigation from Rudy Giuliani and Trump's legal team. That being said, even though there may be some legitimate concerns in a factual or situational reality, we also have to look at, in addition to adjudicating things honestly and making sure anyone who was doing wrong is certainly held accountable, as they should be, is it enough to alter the fate of the election, right? If there are 500 fraudulent ballots that are found in the state of Texas, that person should obviously go to jail. That's also not going to change the outcome in the state of Texas.
Yeah. If you take some specific examples about things that the defenders of Trump are, you know, putting forward, then we can mention the spikes in Biden votes in places like Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, and I think it was also in Detroit and Michigan. And they say that this happened overnight, and how could Biden get like tens of thousands votes overnight, just like that? Do you have any sort of, you know, explanation for that?
Well, it's important to remember the scale in the United States, and even some Americans are frequent to forget this, as we have states with as few people as 500,000 or 600,000, like Wyoming and South Dakota and North Dakota, and then states like Michigan with populations of more than 10 million, and more than the nation of Sweden. Yeah. So it becomes a situation where when you hear 1,000 votes or 10,000 votes or 25,000 votes, it sounds quite a lot until you realize that in an individual state there might have been 9 million ballots cast. And then, you know, 50,000 votes is not that extreme.
No. Okay. Yeah.
And so that's one component of it. The reality is that despite being, you know, one nation from a civic standpoint, we really are, you know, a collaboration of neighborhoods. We see that even in a nation like Sweden with your parliamentary democracy. One party may have extraordinary support in a particular region and very little support in another, based on rural versus urban or different elements. And so likewise, the city of Philadelphia, I don't think has had a Republican mayor in 50 years. So it's not as though, you know, it's strange for Philadelphia to come out for Joe Biden in the end, and perhaps even more so because Joe Biden was technically born in the Philadelphia suburbs. And there is, you know, a little bit of a punch, you know, when a candidate comes from a particular town or district or region, as I'm sure your listeners are familiar with, again, even in places like Sweden, et cetera.
Yeah. When we talk about, you know, the voting machines and the Dominion software or the voting machine itself, do you have any, you know, can you explain how it works? And, you know, they're talking now Sidney Powell and Rudy Giuliani about, you know, it comes from Venezuela and things like that.
So it's interesting topic. It's actually an interesting interplay between your system of democracy and ours, in that, as your listeners are well aware, but most Americans are not, in Sweden and most parliamentary democracies, it's necessary to pass a threshold of viability, right? So, for instance, if your party gets 0.25% of the vote in Sweden, you don't get into parliament. It doesn't mean that you didn't get any votes. It just means you didn't get enough votes to matter. And therefore, the vote is then weighted, and those votes for parties that didn't pass the threshold are eliminated in terms of the weighting schedule, and the seats are distributed among the parties that passed the threshold. Americans are very unfamiliar with this system. And so one of the things that shocked some Americans, but unnecessarily, was the discovering that Dominion has a weighted category that you can elect to choose and empower in the recount functions. This is so that they can sell those voting machines to places like Sweden and Germany and Ireland and New Zealand that have parliamentary democracies and therefore have these threshold elements. We don't have that in the United States, as your listeners may be aware. It's a first-past-the-post system. Usually a clear majority is required. Some states do allow you to win with less than 50% of the vote. North Carolina is one of them. California is another. But in any event, there's no thresholding, reweighting. And so when someone brought that up in Dominion software, it confused a lot of Americans. But I do think that bringing it up was disingenuous at best, and perhaps sinister on the behalf of those who are bringing it up, because it's just so confusing to Americans that no one starts out with awareness. And I feel like that's not in the interest of civic discussion to try to introduce things that are unnecessarily confusing, frankly.
Yeah, but would you say, I mean, I have never voted in an American election, obviously, but you obviously have a lot of times. And would you say that when you use these machines, are there any possibility to cheat when you are like voting in the machines? And does these paper ballots, I assume you use paper ballots when you vote and you put them in the machine, do they always get, you know, certified afterwards by audits or by actual people to see if the machines works?
So that's a very excellent question. So depending on the state, you may actually use a voter touchscreen or a paper ballot. In the case of a paper ballot, obviously you know exactly how you voted because you've got the pen and paper and you can confirm right to your eyes. In the case of the machine, voting element that actually in many states, not all, unfortunately, and I do believe that element should be changed in the future, but in many states you get a printout receipt, almost like when you go to the store and you can confirm the items that you bought and what the price was. Similarly, you get a printout that says, you know, you voted for these people, and you could double check that and make sure that there's no, you know, confusion. There are anecdotally, there are elements that sometimes glitch, like any system that's used 100 million times. You know, you won't be surprised if it's only 99.9999% accurate. That being said, again, there's very little indication of any errors. Sometimes people do forget to bubble in a specific bubble as well as they should have, and it could cause the machine to misread, and so they will go back through and double check, and there is a function for auditing. And that's why your listeners will probably have heard a lot about the last week or two the notion of a certified election result as opposed to just a published election result. And this too is a thing that not only many of your listeners but many Americans are just not well familiar with. And the fact that while you have a preliminary result, and as long as that result is considerable, for instance, with a candidate winning by, you know, 5, 10, 15%, then there's really no doubt or disputing what perhaps a tenth of a percent may or may not have done, or what some late ballots that come in over the last 5 or 6 days will do, even if it's 1,000 votes. You know, it's very unlikely to change because of the magnitude of the victories. That being said, there is a difference between the results that we get on election day, typically, or in this case, over the few days following the election, and the literal certified result. And that certified result is a process of the local boards of elections, which are made up of both Democrats and Republicans in every instance. And they literally go through each precinct's voter tapes. They go through any ballots that came in belatedly. They go through ballots that were filed as what they call provisional ballots. If someone's ballot literally gets physically destroyed by the machine, again, not often the case. But again, out of 100 million ballots, you are going to have a feeder error occasionally that's going to tear up a ballot. You know, and they make sure and they come to an agreement as the local board as to what happened. And in most cases, it requires at least a 2/3 majority, meaning that one political party doesn't have enough votes to make the determination outcome. It does have to have support from at least some of the members of the other political party to certify that local result. So there really are a lot of safeguards built in. That's not to say that each literal individual vote is guaranteed to be perfect, but this is why it matters whether an election is 50 votes difference or 50,000, right? And in every instance, statewide, with the possible exceptions of Georgia and Wisconsin, we know now that the voter totals are far outside the bounds of, you know, something that a few hundred or even a few thousand votes could change the outcome of.
Yeah. If you talk about Georgia, Georgia has just finished its hand recount of the votes, and Donald Trump is not happy because, you know, the hand recount basically said that, well, Biden still won. So what is it that Donald Trump complains about? I think it's something about affidavits or something like that. Can you explain why he complains and, you know, comment if he's correct or wrong?
Well, again, you know, the problem is that two things can be true at once, right? There can be some election fraud and some election hijinks that shouldn't have happened. And those frauds and hijinks may also not be responsible for changing the outcome of the election. And it's one of those things where I feel like politically he's playing a bit fast and loose with the facts, in the sense that he is absolutely right to hold people accountable under the law for any thing that they did, either intentionally or even accidentally, as may also be the case in a few instances of just the system not working quite right in a particular city or county or precinct. But in and of itself, that's not grounds for calling the entirety of the election into question. And it seems as though he is, unfortunately, in my opinion, comfortable with misstating the magnitude of these issues. And so, yes, he does have affidavits, and yes, there are issues, but those issues do not seem to be of a level of significance that would call into question the electoral outcome.
One other thing with Georgia, I mean, Georgia is a Republican state, basically. I mean, the governor, I assume, is a Republican. You know, most of the people running the show are Republicans, so they can't, they obviously are not Democrats. Is that correct?
That is correct, and that's a further example of a situation where it's a bit too cute by half, as they say. And in fact, we know that some of the late ballots in Georgia, for instance, did help Donald Trump gain some votes, relatively speaking. It wasn't enough, but he did actually benefit from those further countings. So, you know, again, each town and each region and each state have their own differences politically. But yeah, in the instance of the state of Georgia, for instance, the head of all elections for the state and indeed the elections of most of the county and cities are also in charge of Republicans. But it's just, you know, a misnomer to think that obviously Republicans are not trying to steal the election for Joe Biden in this instance. So, you know, it, I understand why he wants to win and obviously a desire to push the envelope in every way that he can. But at a certain point, he does need to come to terms with the reality that he lost genuinely, if not by an overwhelming landslide.
Yeah, I want you to comment some few other states also. Wisconsin is another example because he has demanded a recount in, I think it's in 3 counties in Wisconsin. And I remember in 2016, I actually read an article in Milwaukee Journal that Jill Stein from the Green Party, she demanded a recount in 2016 to prove that, you know, Trump had cheated or that someone had cheated on his behalf in Wisconsin. And they made a recount and they basically said that, well, Donald Trump won, that's a fact, and you know, it's nothing to, this is, it's all over, Donald Trump won. So that was basically the opposite situation of today, and I found it very interesting. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely, and further to the point, we've had, you know, unfortunately, this is not our first go round in this. You know, some of your older listeners may well remember the 2000 election between George W. and Al Gore. I know you personally were really front and center paying attention to that as a young man. And likewise, in 2004, John Kerry had a legitimate complaint about some things that happened in Ohio in a particular county that probably produced as many as 1,000 false ballots for George W. Bush. But the truth is that George W. won the state of Ohio by more than 50,000 votes. So even if you assume that, you know, all of those 1,000 votes and even 10 times that many were erroneously for George W., he would have still won by 30,000 votes. So it doesn't matter. No. And which is, again, not to say that we shouldn't hold individuals and officials accountable for either mistakes or intentional frauds. That's a separate and related issue to election integrity. And I think U.S. Senator Pat Toomey, Republican from Pennsylvania, as well as a number of other Republicans have voiced that opinion. We do need to make sure that our elections are being conducted with the greatest amount of integrity and accuracy from errors and mistakes. But that doesn't give us grounds to call into question the outcome when the magnitude's just not there, frankly.
No. You know, Trump has most of his lawsuits, I think, not all, but a lot of them. He has won some. I think he's won in Pennsylvania, one lawsuit, and I think a lot of other has been, you know, cast out by the judges in these different courts in these different states. But does he have any chances to win, you know, any, you know, meaningful court cases?
Well, I guess meaningful is in the eye of the beholder. I suspect that he may win one or two more challenges on a matter of fact here and there. But whether it will be have an appreciable outcome, I think, you know, as I said during another interview earlier this week, that you know, even if a very close state like Wisconsin or Georgia, or frankly both, were to flip all the way to Donald Trump, while it would certainly make the margin much closer, right? Wisconsin with its 11 electoral votes, Georgia with its 15. Even if you flip 26, Joe Biden still has 280 when 270 is necessary, and he's still the president-elect, and Donald Trump still lost, albeit by a much closer margin.
Yeah. A technical question. After, the media has said that Donald Trump had won, they proclaimed Joe Biden as the president-elect, I think on November 7th or something like that. At least I think that a president-elect can only be, called if the if the challenger or the sitting president in this case gives his concession, and Trump obviously did not, or until the Electoral College, confirms that Joe Biden had won. Was it right to proclaim Joe Biden as the president-elect on like November 7th, or should the media have waited until a concession from Trump or until December 14th?
Yeah, so those are both excellent questions. I would say that I do think November 7th may have been a bit early. I happened to be in Detroit, Michigan when that happened, and was there for the kind of the public outbursts of support and celebration from Vice President Biden's supporters. So that was a bit fun to see. It was a very positive experience for them. I know that not everyone is pleased with that, but it was a bit of a sigh of relief. And that may have been what some of the news agencies were pushing. That being said, my preference would be to wait till at least election certification, which has now mostly happened in most states, or will be happening over the course of the next week. So whether you say state certification or the Electoral College vote, but I might add state certification in there as well, which would speed up the time process by a week or two possibly. But in the interest of decorum, I think that it's a bit unnecessary to publicly proclaim someone as the vice president-elect until the election's been certified. I don't know that it helps anything. And in these certain circumstances where people do have a bit of a raw emotion, it might have been better left to wait a week.
Yeah, Donald Trump seems to be running out of options now. Most of his lawsuits won't, it won't get him anywhere. And I read today that he's now trying to press legislators in Michigan and in other states to make the Electoral College to not confirm Biden, and that would mean to force the Electoral College to vote against the people. Is that even legal? How will this play out?
So the long and short of it is no. In a couple of very unique instances, it's theoretically possible. But for instance, the governor has a role to play as well. So like in Michigan, for instance, even though the Republicans control both houses of the legislature, the governor is rather notoriously not only a Democrat, but someone who openly loathes the president. And therefore, she would veto any change of law that they would force through, which would be how they would have to go about doing it. And they don't have the votes necessary in the chamber, even if they wanted to do it. So it won't be happening in Michigan. Likewise, in Pennsylvania, similar issue. Georgia has a Republican legislature and governor, so in theory they could get it done there. But as discussed, it's just not enough places that matter. Wisconsin has a Democratic governor, Pennsylvania, Michigan. So, Arizona currently as well. So now you've got a situation where likewise North Carolina, although it does look like North Carolina is going to be certified for Trump, but there's just not enough states where it could even be done if they wanted to do so. Then, of course, you have political backlash potential, and there's also the fundamental notion of fair play. And this is where I would argue that President Trump is starting to cross some boundaries in terms of decorum. And nobody likes a sore loser, including him. I think he was right to chastise Secretary Clinton for her lack of magnanimity and dignity in the way she treated him when he beat her, fair and square. And likewise, the Democrats have absolutely had it out for him. I don't think you can look around at the media and the partisanship and not acknowledge that Donald Trump has had crosshairs on him, so to speak, from day one, and that they've beat him up over anything and everything, including the phony Russian, you know, election collusion story that, you know, so carried the early days of his administration. And so I understand his anger and his frustration. They're warranted and valid, but that doesn't allow him or excuse him behaving in the same fashion, frankly.
Yeah, you know, earlier this evening, Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell and Donald Trump's other top lawyers held a press conference. And, you know, a couple of days ago, Sidney Powell said that she would release the Kraken, that, you know, the monster from the Pirates of the Caribbean movies. And I laughed when I watched it, and I thought that, okay, that sounds dramatic. And, well, today, one of the other lawyers tweeted that, Jan Ellis tweeted that Rudy Giuliani and Sidney Powell released the Kraken, and she tweeted this after the press conference. And I watched the press conference, and I thought that, okay, you're talking about a lack of affidavits in Pennsylvania. You say talk a lot about Rudy Giuliani, that is, that Philadelphia has a long history of corruption and other big Democratic cities, and that might be true, but, you know, that is not the Kraken. That was my thought.
I bluntly and simply, I agree. I think it, you know, again, there may be some cause for individual concern and frustration at either the conduct or the actions of a few individuals here and there, including some of the way that in this particular the city of Philadelphia behaved as it related to the fair and equal treatment of some of the Republican election observers. But again, not to the point of, I mean, we're now talking, I think, somewhere in the order of 90,000 votes or something in Pennsylvania. And it's just preposterous to believe that there could be a conspiracy to steal, you know, 100,000 or more votes.
Yeah, but you know, the United States, you do have a history of like cheating and things like that in you know, in small districts. You know, you have this sort of like baron, king politicians who sit like forever, and you know, they cheat and they, you know, they bribe a lot of people and things like that. You have a history of that. Does that still exist, you know, on a local level in the United States?
So there's a few regions in America, and I happen to be from one of them, that are a bit notorious for this. One is New Jersey. One is Cook County, Chicago. Another is southeastern Louisiana. And the other are the rural mountain communities of southern Appalachia. Each one has a different way of going about it. In the case of southern Appalachia and Louisiana, one of the things they benefit from is a very rural population. And therefore, 100 or 200 stolen votes really can alter the entire course of the election. So it's not that difficult to do in those cases, as well as a lack of information technology and a lack of good journalism, as is common in rural America, right? More of the weekly local newspaper, you know, and who is probably the only paper in town, et cetera. And so it's a little easier to get one over on people in those communities. And I would say that it's and likewise in Cook County and New Jersey, it tends to happen more on the internal party level of who's going to run for the office, a bit of deciding the election before the election's even held kind of thing tends to be what their corruption looks like. And frankly, then state senator Barack Obama benefited from this greatly. In Chicago, the only reason he's the United States Senator is because a federal judge went to prison for something that involved electoral fraud that got him into the U.S. Senate. Now, of course, his presidential election was less of an issue, but his election to the U.S. Senate was absolutely a case of Cook County, Chicago doing what they do best. But the with the daily machine, as we call it. But it's one of those things where for those of us who are junkies like you and I and probably many of your listeners, I will say that unfortunately, the elaborate and exciting mysteries of these electoral frauds and behaviors that make for almost spy novel level intrigue are more a thing of the past than they are of the present, due in large part due to the information technology gap and citizen journalism, you know, not unlike yourself. You know, 40 years ago, your podcast would not exist, not only technologically, but it would be more of a centralized media approach. And yet now, you know, you've been able to, you know, share your thoughts and opinions and gather folks like myself to come speak to, you know, at this point, tens of thousands of folks throughout the world, vis-a-vis citizen journalism, which I love and respect, and I appreciate that about you. But of course, you are one of, you know, many thousands of these people around the world, and in the process have really brought an open light to something that was a bit more arcane, you know, 20 and 30 years ago, when it was a bit easier to get away with some of the nonsense.
Oh, I see. Very interesting. But, you know, okay, we have, you know, we have basically said that Donald Trump's narrative is wrong. He, you know, there is no, you know, overwhelming cheat, and, you know, the Democrats did not steal the election. But you have the other side also. You have, you know, the Federal Election Commission, and you even have Christopher Krebs. He just got fired today, who was the security, cybersecurity infrastructure chief. He was the chief of that agency under the Department of Homeland Security. And both he and the Federal Election Commission has basically said that this election, the 2020 presidential election, has been the safest election in history. That is basically the opposite of what Trump is saying. Do you think they are correct in that assessment?
I mean, I've seen, again, you know, just knowing, you know, my last 20 years in electoral work, and then having an arm's length attachment to stuff that went on before then with some of my mentors, I can tell you that cheating, to your point earlier, is a bit of an American pastime. And it's gotten so much harder to do, and there's so much easier with information technology. You know, individual campaigns now have the ability to perform an audit based on the print off of who voted, and you could spot check, you know, 1,000 unlikely voters, people who maybe haven't voted before. And individual voters tend to be very honest, to the point that if you called them up and said, "Hey, I know you haven't voted in the last four elections. Did you vote this time?" They would tell you yes, they did, or no, they didn't. And if there was electoral cheating, the easiest way to do it would be voting these infrequent voters, you know, fake balloting in this regard. And we've seen no, you know, evidence of this from you know, any form of audit. And, you know, every other form of cheating would be so marginal as to, you know, really barely exist from a statistical analysis standpoint.
Yeah, so they are basically correct then. But, you know, to get back to the press conference, you know, Rudy Giuliani used to be called the America's mayor after 9/11. I remember that time very well, because I was a big fan of George W. Bush, you know, the whole war on terror and things like that. And he was a hero when he stood there and, you know, talked in New York after 9/11. And he was also a tough cop in New York during the 1990s. Here in Sweden in the 80s, everyone said that, oh, don't go to New York, it's so dangerous to be there. I don't know if that was true, but, you know, a lot of good things happened during the 1990s, during Rudy Giuliani's rule there. But, you know, after, you know, go out like this defending Trump to basically to any price and say that the election was stolen and things like that, this is a message that he conveys all over the world. And he basically says that, you know, the American electoral system cannot be trusted. We are the world's oldest modern democracy, and we basically founded democracy in the modern world. But you can't trust our system. That is basically what he says. And, you know, that, except for that, it is not true. I don't believe it's true. You don't believe it's true. You know, it tarnishes his reputation a lot. Do you think, like, that Sidney Powell, I mean, she is also the defender of General Michael Flynn, who I'm a great fan of, and I hope he gets, you know, released soon. But, you know, don't you think that these people, Sidney Powell, Giuliani, and the others, tarnish their own reputation by, you know, going down on this path?
I do, and it comes as a little bit of personal chagrin. And, you know, I had the pleasure of meeting Mayor Giuliani on more than one occasion. I admire what he did to take on New York organized crime, you know, so significantly in the 80s and 90s. And I do, too. share a lot of sympathy for him and his management of 9/11 and the post 9/11 world. I think that he showed a real character and strength in those hours and days. And most Americans thought very fondly of him for quite some time due to that. And I think that he in particular has just really, really done himself a great disservice with this. And I, for the life of me, I don't understand it. You know, some of these other folks, they don't have as much of a national profile, and therefore, you know, they can probably chalk it up to just being a hired gun. But I do think in the instance of Mayor Giuliani in specific, I think he has really tarnished his legacy pretty strongly at this point. And that's a damn shame.
Yeah. You know, Donald Trump does not seem to, you know, surrender quite yet. Do you think he will? Do you think he will, you know, proceed and basically give his concession? Or does he have to be, you know, does he have to wait to maybe like January 19th or something?
I think that, you know, to your point, I think once the Electoral College is completed here in the next couple of weeks, that will put an end to this for once and for all. But yeah, to your point, he appears incapable of doing so with grace or graciousness, and that's a real shame.
You know, to conclude, but I also want to comment about the other side, because, you know, we basically say that Donald Trump has lost, and he does not seem to realize that himself, but he has lost, and in very soon he has to realize that and comes to terms with that. But, you know, he hasn't been treated fair by the media, and at the moment there are a lot of people that talks about, oh, look, Trump is, you know, he's doing all these, you know, meaningless lawsuits, he's a dictator, and he's like, this is how a tyrant behaves. You know, you also have that side. Do you have any comment about that? Because I think that, you know, both sides goes to, like, they fall in two different, they just go in opposite direction.
Absolutely. And I do appreciate some of that. And I do think it's important for your listeners to be aware that, you know, as I said earlier, it's possible for two different things to be true simultaneously. I think most of us who have a fair-minded approach would certainly argue that Donald Trump has been mistreated, and that journalism as a whole has done a disservice by mistreating his presidency and accusing him of being guilty of things that just simply weren't true on more than one occasion. It was common to make the joke there for a little while that if Donald Trump walked on water, the Washington Post would report as Donald Trump can't swim. And so, you know, it's fair to say that he has been given rough treatment and unfair treatment, while at the same time, he also hasn't learned how to play them in return. One of the things, for instance, that, you know, Ronald Reagan was so famous for was not that the media loved him. In fact, they hated him almost as much as they hate Trump, but they couldn't get away with it because he was just so talented at finding ways to make the broad populace really like him and laugh with him. And he could really, you know, once he grabbed the microphone, you know, kind of command the situation and take the people away from the media. Governor Mike Huckabee had a lot of skill in this regard as well. And even George W. at times was capable of rising above the media element. Conservatives are used to being picked on by the media, frankly, although I would argue that Donald Trump's not much of a conservative. But in the process, the other reality is that we also know that, and as was being discussed even today on one of the programs I watched, how somewhere near 2/3 of Democrats believed as recently as 2019 that there was actual electoral interference with the votes and voting machines by the Russians, even though no one argues that this is true on an intelligence or you know, jurisprudence legal standpoint. Like, nobody says that that happened. And yet 2/3 of Democrats think that it did. So I don't know whether it's good or bad.
In 2016, then, you mean?
Yeah. The 2016 election. And so I don't know whether it's good or bad news that for the last 4 years, 2/3 of one of the political party supporters have thought something that's factually incorrect and untrue, and yet the country still managed to move forward to some degree. So perhaps in that sense, we can take a bit of solace in that there may be a huge portion of Republicans who believe that Joe Biden stole this election, even if it's not true. And yet the country will move forward regardless. That's not necessarily the happiest of news, but it's also not the worst of news.
But that is interesting. And then I have to ask one more question, because this polarization between these two different worlds, Democrats who believe that the Republicans or the Russians stole the election in 2016, and the Republicans that believe that Joe Biden or the Democrats stole the election in 2020. I mean, we are two different worlds, but can they still live together? Because the analysis that they do here in Sweden is that this is like two different countries. But can you still live like Americans, even when you have like these two really different worldviews? Is that possible? Or do you like fight on the streets and things like that?
Well, that is the $64,000 question of the moment, I'm afraid, Ronnie. The truth is that America has been drifting apart for some time, really most of the last 20 years. And a lot of it is the divide between rural and urban America, and the fact that the lifestyles and subcultures are just so dramatically different in terms of the basic day-to-day life and what it's like to be, for instance, primarily involved in agricultural production or mining or some of these more traditional forms of economy that have more to do with the, you know, past, you know, history of the world than the hyper-technical world of the 21st century that is, you know, largely settled in these urban environs and where that lifestyle is fully inundated in the folks who live in cities. And it leads to a difference of political worldview, of lifestyle choices. And it's a very real concern, not just in America, but really around the world even. I think, you know, the more recent elections in Sweden have shown that there is a significant divide between Stockholm and the rest of the country and in the way that they view the politics. And we see similar behavior in Berlin versus rural Germany or Dublin versus the rest of Ireland, et cetera. And so I do think that this is a challenging time for all of us. It is maybe magnified in the United States due to the physical geographic size of the country as well, provides an additional sense of distance. I mean, what on earth does a fellow from Montana have to know or care about a fellow from Manhattan, New York? They're, you know, three to 4,000 kilometers apart and a world of difference. So fair enough. And I do think that I'm hopeful that Joe Biden, he certainly is implied in the last stages of his campaign and after the election day, he has struck a very moderate tone, a very conciliatory tone for the most part. He's leaving it to others if they want to be combative. He lets, you know, them carry that water. He's been mostly focused on kind of creating an discussion. And I think if he appoints a couple of higher profile Republicans to his cabinet, that will help tremendously as well, although I'm sure the far left will not appreciate it. And so, you know, it's really up to him to set a tone that says that we are one country, one nation under God, as our pledge, you know, says. And if he does that, then I think that certainly the worst elements of this can be tempered down. I'm not foolish enough to think that it will disappear overnight or even in a single four-year administration, no matter how well it's done. I think there are some real divides, both culturally and demographically, that are going to have to be discussed. Personally, I think it's a greater argument for devolving more power to the states to where people feel less intruded upon by other states that don't necessarily have much to do with one another. The notion that what does California have any right to tell what somebody in Alabama is doing or vice versa? And we could do this by devolving power more to the states and to local governments to where people don't feel like folks who have no knowledge of their day-to-day lifestyle are dictating too much of their government. I think this is a good way to bring people back into feeling more like neighbors and fellow countrymen and less like they're being managed from without. in the same way that I'm sure there are folks in northern Sweden who probably resent Stockholm's influence on their day-to-day lives.
Yeah, but I don't think Sweden is not that polarized because, you know, in Sweden we do not have, like in America, you have like these fights on the streets where, you know, left-wing people jump, Antifa, you know, jumps on, you know, like older men, conservative people. We don't have that in Sweden, really. But, you know, that brings me to my final question, and that is, would you say that conservatives are more tolerant than liberals in general? Because here in Sweden we have the opposite view. We believe that since liberals believe, you know, in gay marriage and like everything that we believe in Sweden, they must be more tolerant. But my assumption is, and I know a lot of conservatives, I know you and I know a lot of others, that you are very tolerant. And, you know, so my question is, like in you know, day-to-day life in America, who would you say are the most tolerant as persons, liberals or conservatives?
That's a great question, and one that's really come to fore in the last few years as well. And I would have to say that it's important to recognize that most people are neither liberal nor conservative. I would say that most Americans fall somewhere in between those points. Of the two, I would say conservatives. And the reason for that is there's an inherent libertarianism embedded in conservatism that just says, me and my house will do things this way, without a desire to tell anyone else how to live their lives. Whereas, as we know, the far left is very famous for its virtue signaling and kind of making a character judgment about people who, you know, may or may not, you know, engage in vegetarian or veganism or agnosticism or atheism or any of these other, you know, different worldviews that are often shared amongst the left. There's a bit of a values-based judgment against those who don't agree with them, and the silencing, or what I think they're calling the cancel culture. Whereas on the conservative side of things, it tends to be, you know, do what you want over in your house, but leave me alone. And, you know, which is not to say that it's kindness always, but there is a tolerance among conservatives that I feel is lacking too often on the left. And I would say that for those who really fall in between in the mix, I would say that there is a certain amount of tolerance as well. I will say that I have been disappointed by some of President Trump's very core supporters taking a really hostile view, very similar, frankly, to some of the like Ocasio-Cortez left, in making moral judgments against people who disagree with them politically. I think that's a bad tone to take. And I do think that we have to remember throughout America, and indeed throughout the West, and that includes, you know, our friends and allies in Sweden, that which unites us is far greater than that which divides us. The truth of the matter is, you know, that, you know, when it comes to the major battles of the ages against things like Nazi Germany or against things, you know, like, you know, slavery or some of the more modern issues of human rights, we stand together. And that doesn't mean that we stand perfectly unified at all times. But God save us from such a day when, if there is a 5 or 10% difference between our views, that we burn the bridge. Because that means that we will all, whether it be those in Sweden or those in the United States or those throughout the world, I think that's a very lonely planet and not one I wish to be a part of.
No, I totally agree there. I totally agree. All right. Thanks a lot, Justin, for taking time. Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Ronnie, and I hope you have wonderful holidays coming up.
Det var avsnitt 1232 av amerikanska nyhetsanalyser, en konservativ podcast som finns för att ge dig perspektiv på USA som svensk media inte ger. Stöd gärna med en gåva på swishnummer 070 30 28 95 0 eller genom att via hemsidan stödja på PayPal, Patreon eller bankkonto. Det var allt för idag. Tack för att ni har lyssnat.
Mm-hmm.